First of all, Prime Minister, thank you very much for hosting us today here in 10 Downing Street. It's my first time in this building, so it's a little thrill in it as well. I was, we spoke on the way in, and I was reminded of that famous scene in Love Actually where Hugh Grant does his dance down the stairs. But apparently it wasn't actually filmed here, so I didn't get a chance to see the stairs.
And it's Wednesday, June the 21st, the longest day of 2017. You're very welcome to the latest edition of the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan, and with me in studio today, Mary Minahan and Fia Kelly from our political staff. You just heard the Taoiseach there speaking to the press following his first meeting in 10 Downing Street. I should say I have only seen Love Actually once, and I have to admit I found the whole thing smug, shallow and really rather boring. But enough about Leo Varadkar's new government. Mary, what did you think of Love Actually?
I hate Love Actually. Can I come out as saying that? I just can't stand it. It makes me feel a bit queasy.
It is. It's really creepy. Ooh. Kind of thing, isn't
I mean,
it?
There are certain vignettes in it that are good, like the Alan Rickman and is it Emily Thompson?
The dancing down the the Hugh Grant dancing down the stairs to Jump is not one of those vignettes.
Definitely
though, is
not
it?
One of the highlights at all. And what struck me was that if Enda Kenny had gone abroad and said something like that, he would have been absolutely crucified. Wouldn't he?
It's bad enough that he does the air guitar to Bruce Springsteen in Croke Park, isn't it, Fia? I mean, I think we all thought that one of the things was we didn't have an embarrassing Taoiseach now, but clearly we were wrong.
Clearly, our hopes have been dashed quite quickly. I think, you know, oftentimes Enda Kenny tried to be cool, and I think we just saw our new Taoiseach attempt quite badly to be cool as well. He actually did raise Love Actually once before, someone pointed out to me the other day, that he also, in a previous NAF episode, he hosted a radio show over Christmas where he showed off his musical knowledge, and he used the Joni Mitchell.
Beyond my professional requirements.
But apparently, he pointed out to me that he used the Joni Mitchell song as one of his favorite songs ever, because it was from one of his favorite movies ever, which is Love Actually.
It's a lovely moment in the movie. I'll give it that.
I'm going to try some deep pop psychology then. Yeah. Why not? Love Actually was released in about 2003. It's about the peak of the Blair, or just when the Blair years were going sour, actually. Mm. But it's a very Blairite kind of a film. Young Leo at that point, with just being kind of starting to set his cap towards thinking of running for the local elections a couple of years later. Do you think maybe he models himself on Hugh Grant?
What a question. Possibly, but I wouldn't want to delve any further in the comparisons between the two men, you know. One has a very hostile attitude to the press, for a start.
Indeed. I think, though, it seemed to have gone quite well in Britain, didn't it? I know Channel 4 News highlighted it. But I suppose there was a big contrast for the Brits in terms of this wide-eyed, innocent abroad, as they saw him, Leo Varadkar, contrasted with the hunted Prime Minister that they have in Britain,
the fact is that
Theresa May.
Over the last few weeks, through the prism of the British media, which obviously they look through everything through the disaster that has been Theresa May's last month or so. So also last week I read a piece, and I can't remember which British newspaper it was, but which was very favourably comparing Enda Kenny's very last speech in the opening of the new National Gallery and the kind of the way in which it articulated the nation and its history and its future, and comparing that with the you know, Theresa May's disaster with Grenfell last week and her inability actually to do the same thing.
I suppose you know, but like,
I mean, we tend to be a bit meaner to our own local leaders.
The domestic audience will always look to the bits it likes, and you know, will select attributes of other leaders that will compare favorably to its own. Like, you know, if we wanted to look abroad, we would go, oh, look at just like, actually, you've heard it in the last 2 days. Leo Varadkar compares himself to Justin Trudeau and Macron. Those guys would never have such an outrageously male-dominated cabinet and ministerial ranks, you know, da-da-da-da. So we always look to what we see as the good elements of leaders abroad. So it's quite like... And the other thing, the thing I felt that Love Actually thing, I just thought it was a bit... It wasn't appropriate, really, because he had, in previous utterances, you know, expressed condolences to the British people on the Grenfell tragedy, the previous instance of terrorism. So it just didn't quite fit... It wasn't befitting of
and
the
it's
occasion.
Kind of awkward, isn't it? Even if you listen to the quote, you know, there's this kind of nerdy, geeky thing kicks in there. But there's all this business of, it isn't actually where they shot it. They shot it on a studio set, I'm told.
Which carried through yesterday.
We're very familiar with that side of Leo Varadkar. I think that didn't surprise us at all.
And it carried through yesterday in his leader's questions when obviously someone brought this up. I think Gerry Adams said, I think actually Gerry Adams had a good line. He says, this wasn't quite the spirit of Michael Collins and Downing Street, you know, you invoking Hugh Grant. And then Leo Varadkar had this really awful prepared joke that he kind of shuffled the paper towards him and said, "Oh, Deputy Adams, I think you're a fan of Richard Curtis's later work." What was the movie?
It was About Time.
About Time. A really, really terrible time-travelling rom-com.
I had no idea what it was.
You don't want to see it. Listen, nobody wants to see it.
Obviously, my cultural hinterland is lacking in the...
No, it's not. It's not by not seeing that.
Time-travelling rom-com?
But then, Leo Varadkar says, you know, it's about time you got the Stormont institutions up and running. Yawn, groan.
I've got a strange feeling Gerry Adams is not up on his Richard Curtis films perhaps as much as he should be either. You know, it wouldn't really be his cultural hinterland either, would it?
No.
Anyway, all that goes as a very lengthy preamble to saying, Fiac, that he hasn't had a great first week, Leo Varadkar.
No, he hasn't after the, you know, initial warm glow of the youngest ever Taoiseach and the razzmatazz of the Fine Gael leadership election. He was very much brought back to earth, particularly over the appointment of Maura Whelan, the former Attorney General, to the Court of Appeal.
Does he bear any blame for that? Or was he just
I think he was left with it, but I think what happened is Fianna Fáil, quite logically from their point of view, have used it as a battering ram to prevent any bounce that he may get. So the polls so far, it's his first week as Taoiseach, previous polls where it was obvious he was going to be Taoiseach, kind of had Fine Gael 30% there, thereabouts. I think Fianna Fáil have tried to use this as a way of making sure that he doesn't get a bounce in the next set of opinion polls, that this is one of the first things the public see, this grubby, insider-ish appointment, as they would characterise it. I think it is unfair. I think Enda Kenny put it on the agenda at his last cabinet meeting. I think Leo Varadkar was quite constrained in what he could do. I think it's unfortunate that it's been left for him to deal with, but he has had to deal with it and it hasn't looked great. But he clearly made his position quite clear, quite quickly. In fact, on numerous times over the weekend, from Friday into Saturday into Sunday, he stuck by the line that Maura Whelan is a very good appointment. She's eminently qualified and we are sticking to it.
Mary, by forcing the issue in a way, it's a bit like, I have to admit, holidays are on my mind at the moment, and I was thinking it's a bit like going into your Airbnb and finding that somebody's left a horrible mess in the toilet bowl, and the first thing you have to do is get out the domestics and the rubber gloves. And he just had to do it as quickly as possible, didn't he? And he forced the issue by getting the president to do the dirty deed.
Yes,
yesterday morning.
Also, I suppose, to some extent, by putting it up to Fianna Fáil. You know, I think the thinking within Leo Varadkar's camp has been to keep calm and carry on, and that this will, it's not nice, but it'll blow over. I think that's the way they're thinking about it. And he has, you know, almost with a shrug at the weekend said, look, everybody knows that Fianna Fáil can collapse the government if they choose to do so. So it was very much the ball's in your court, Micheál Martin. So I think Micheál Martin made what was probably the correct political decision not to collapse the government over this issue on the grounds that he clearly doesn't like it. He thinks the whole thing stinks, but he doesn't think Fianna Fáil would be rewarded for collapsing the government and plunging the country into a fresh election over this. Yeah, over this issue. I think they just make a political calculation that, you know, their doors aren't being beaten down by people saying to them, this is an awful throwback of a process of appointing judges. You know, people have a lot of things going on in their own lives. They're just maybe not too concerned about that. So I think the view Micheál Martin has taken is that the party wouldn't be rewarded now for making everyone go to the polls. They'd probably stay now until the third budget is in place. And the other factor they have to consider is, are they ready in terms of candidates, money and so on? Probably not. And I'm not saying Fianna Fáil any more than any other party. I think, you know, it's amazing actually how behind political parties are in that.
As Fiac says, it is a useful stick for Fianna Fáil to beat Fine Gael with and to, you know, kill a bit of their bounce and take a bit of the lustre off the new Taoiseach. And a couple of other incidents, even before we come to the formation of the cabinet as a whole and the junior ministers, even the kind of bit of a spat over Mary Mitchell O'Connor and is she actually a junior minister and will she be able to access the salary? And will that require Fianna Fáil to approve that? And if not, that's all a bit messy. It kind of, I heard Heather Humphreys on the radio at the weekend being attacked over all this, and of course her travails with Imma and appointments to boards, which damaged Fine Gael at a time because, you know, part of Fine Gael's USP is we're not like Fianna Fáil. We don't do these dirty tricks. Yeah. So when it's shown that they do, it, you know, it does them no good at all. Really,
she, I mean, it is messy. There's no other word for it. It's been a messy, messy start. Mm. Heather Humphreys is a good example, actually, of a politician who can recover from a very rocky start. And she did have that terrible thing with Emma at the beginning when she looked like she was absolutely finished before she'd even begun. But she steadied the ship. And I think she gets a bit of credit for how she handled the 2016 commemorations and so on, and has obviously kept very close to Leo Varadkar and has been rewarded for that. And I think is going to play quite a central role now in his cabinet. But yes, the thing about Mary Mitchell O'Connor, oh, it kind of makes you cringe, doesn't it, when you hear them discussing it in Leinster yeah. House yesterday. And Leo Varadkar kind of forced into a position to say, look, if this does need legislation to kind of bump up her pay to bring her up in line with the other super juniors, then it won't be prioritised because, you know, he's basically saying it wouldn't look good to prioritise legislation
My ministers are not interested in money. Yeah. My ministers are interested in the job and not interested in the salary that job may command, is what he said yesterday. I would wonder if you asked the people around the table if they felt the same thing, would they agree with him? But I think I think that Mary Mitchell O'Connor wage thing can fall one of two ways. One is that it looks really grubby, which it does, and that he didn't give advanced thought to the fact that this could become an issue because he doesn't have the majority in the House to pass such legislation. The other is that it feeds into the criticism of his cabinet as being male heavy, in that he will have a number of junior ministers who get that salary, and super junior ministers, and the one super junior who doesn't is female. That's something that's now circulating as well. And that could reflect badly on not just the government, but the body politic yeah. as a whole. So it could fall either way.
You've been widely criticised for the gender balance of the new cabinet, Mary. Is that justified?
The only surprising thing about this is that those around Leo Varadkar are surprised at the reaction. I mean, they think they managed expectations. They put out a diktat quite early on that the class of 2016 wouldn't be looked at.
Is that fair enough?
Well, no, I wonder about that, because that is Leo Varadkar cutting himself off from really the only seam that he had to mine of political of female candidates, right? Because, like, we're not talking about a big pool here. He's got 11, Fine Gael has only 11 women TDs out of its big 50-person block, right? Already a number of those are senior ministers, and there are four newcomers, and he has said they can't be looked at all. And that creates a difficulty. Like, the four are actually, the bulk of them are Simon Coveney supporters, which obviously people think is another factor. So that's Kate O'Connell, Maria Bailey, and who's my other one? Hildegard Nocton. And then Josepha Madigan was a key supporter of Leo Varadkar. And she in
been,
fact,
you would have
seconded
thought the
him.
One who might have been most
she definitely,
candidate.
Yeah. And yeah. also Maria Bailey has apparently impressed Mr. Varadkar quite a lot as well. But he deliberately said, no, those women, along with the men who were elected in 2016, can't be looked at all. So therefore, he had an even more restricted pool from which to draw. Now, we'll tease out the positive discrimination thing a bit. Is it fair in the strictest sense that we talked about fairness when we were school kids? No, it's not, right? Is life fair? And did we find that out after we left school? It's not fair, right? So, you know, it creates an awful lot of difficulty. It creates discomfort. It's very, very difficult for every organisation. It's not just politics, you know. Every nearly organisation you go into is top heavy
sure,
with
we're
men
all familiar. We see
for
it in
institutional
our own. We see
reasons.
It, we see
yeah.
this in our own workplace. And you make the point very well, I think, in our Politics Digest this morning about this. I mean, there is some processes were put in place. And again, to be fair to Enda Kenny, were put in place under Enda Kenny's Taoiseachship with the specific aim of having more women elected to the Dáil in particular. And if that were to happen, and that did get some results in the last yeah. election, it meant that you were going to have a cohort of women coming into elected politics for the first time. And there was, you would have thought that then there should be a knock on from that.
Well, exactly.
In exactly the way that you're saying, to seek to fast track some of those women.
Fast track is the word. Catherine Martin, who's the Green Party deputy leader and the founder of the Women's Caucus, the cross party group in the Oireachtas, made the point yesterday that, you know, young girls can't be what they can't see. So, you know, these women, like, let's face it, have factors other than merit been involved in previous and indeed this selection of ministerial appointments? Absolutely, without a doubt. And I think that's why the government spokesman's insistence yesterday that this was all about merit has really, you know, really angered the woman within Fine Gael.
Well, clearly geography played a huge part.
Well, he said himself, because geography, loyalty, merit and gender.
Yeah,
those were his own criteria. He yeah. said it himself. And clearly, like, loyalty was definitely one, because we had Dara Murphy, who was sacked as Minister for European Affairs, saying that he was informed in a phone call, look, I have to reward my supporters. Basically, you picked the wrong side and tough about you. but that was disputed by his spokesman.
But just to be fair to Leo Varadkar for a moment,
he has to do that.
Before we came on air, you were saying, you know, there have been times in the past where people were promoted straight into cabinet having just joined
the new entrance. So I can see, like, it's unfortunate that it is certainly lacking in female representation, and there are a lot of talented female TDs in that 2016 intake, but he quite clearly made a decision earlier on that he would not be promoting people from that class. And Dick Spring, when the Labour Party had its spring tide in 1982, I think they had 32, 33 seats, promoted a number of TDs to the ministerial ranks immediately, junior ministerial ranks. And he felt that that was, in hindsight, a bad decision because they didn't learn the ropes of the Parliament. They didn't learn what it is to be a TD, your bread and butter issues, the workings of the Parliament, how you interact with your constituents, how you look after your constituents. And he felt that that was a negative going into the next election. They hadn't adequately paid attention to their first duty as a parliamentarian rather than their duty as a minister. And perhaps that is an issue that's feeding in. And Bertie Ahern also famously said you'd have to do 2 terms, I think it was, as a TD before he even look at you as a minister. So it's not as if that Leo Varadkar is breaking a precedent here. Okay. He's actually adhering to one.
It's about the expectation fake, isn't it? It's this expectation that because Leo Varadkar has certain attributes that he's going to be progressive and liberal. And that's not necessarily the case. You know, I totally take the point that you do have to cut your teeth in Leinster House, or it's certainly very helpful if you do so. But, you know, against that, it's that case of, you know, Irish women must wait. You know, are they just to wait until there's...
Because I'm not aware, if he does, I'm not aware of it. Has he any public statements on this?
He hasn't actually spoken that much about gender issues. Although, if you remember, do you remember the time Eamon Gilmore, when he was Taoiseach, refused to go and speak to the Hibernian Society, one of those societies in America, because on the grounds that they didn't accept women members. Mm. Now, Leo Varadkar the following year did go, but he made a very pointed speech about how Ireland was changing and how, you know, this organisation should change too. The other intervention I can think of was, I think it was in about 2012 or 2013, if you recall, the insolvency legislation was coming in at that time. And Leo Varadkar was actually brutally honest about a very dodgy part of the draft legislation at that time, where childcare costs would be taken into account if people were being assessed for insolvency. And in effect, you know, if a woman was, which is a very common situation, if a woman was earning less that or about the same amount as her childcare or as the family's childcare costs as it should be, then, you know, maybe she should be giving up her job or thinking about that. Mm. So Leo Varadkar kind of weighed into that debate and I think put the frighteners up a whole load of families by saying, you know, that he actually knew quite a few women in that situation who weren't earning that much money but were kind of keeping their place in the workforce for a couple of years. You know, I think his intentions were okay on that, but he had to issue a clarifying statement very quickly the next morning because a lot of confusion came from that. But to answer your question, I don't think he's actually said that much about gender, but there has been a development today, though, which I think he has sort of realised that this isn't playing well. And the abortion committee, which is sitting for the first time this morning, there had been an assumption that Jerry Bottomer was going to chair that. Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil have a majority there, so they'll get to choose the chair, and Fianna Fáil is certainly not pushing anyone forward. Jerry Bottomer, as you'll recall, did a fairly good job, I think, chairing the committee that led to the Protection of Life During Pregnancy Bill in 2013. But it's not going to be Jerry Bottomer, it's actually going to be Catherine Noone. Mm. So, you know, I think there will...
You think that's partly in reaction to what's happened over the last few days?
He has obeyed the longest running rule of politics in all this is loyalty. Like, the people he promoted were his supporters. The political reality, as he saw it, probably said he had to do it because if you look, I'm looking at the picture in today's paper in front of me right now, John Paul Phelan, Michael Darcy, 2 instrumental players for him within the parliamentary party, which is how he won the leadership. Jim Daly, the only man in Cork, the only TD in Cork to vote for him in the leadership contests. Brendan Griffin, another outspoken anti-Kennyite who supported Varadkar. And the 5th, as far as I know, is Kieran Cannon. That's one that people are kind of scratching their heads at, but we assume it's because Leo Varadkar swept the board in the west of Ireland among councillors, and Kieran Cannon was influential to bring a lot of councillors on board, which brings the membership on board, which convinces people that you're an All-Ireland candidate.
One of the things I wonder about this, Vic, and maybe I just have the wrong end of the stick on it, is that this is not a huge Fine Gael parliamentary party, but it has access, actually, relatively speaking, historically, to quite a number of, you know, quite a lot of rich pickings in terms of its percentage of the cabinet and its percentage of junior ministerships. Surely it should have been a little bit easier for him to do this than the kind of bit of a mess.
It's never easy because, and the strength of his victory in the parliamentary party made it all the more difficult. Yeah, it would have been easier for him if he won by a smaller margin amongst TDs and senators. I think it was, 51-22 in the end. So he had a lot of mouths to feed and a lot of expectations. Yeah. And that's what led to the disgruntlement, like the people left out, like Pat Deering, again, a strong supporter of his who was spoken out against Enda Kenny. John Deasy in particular, people were feeling very sore for last night because he's been in Leinster House 15 years. He was frozen out under the Kenny years. People felt that if this was a new administration, he would be brought in, but he wasn't. Mm. So I think the fact that he had so many mouths to feed, even though he had a much greater range of options than any leader previous, and because his parliamentary party was so small and his range of ministry was so big.
I'm sure as well that there was bound to be some people listening to this who are going, oh, what the hell is all this about? What are these jobs about? And we are really, all of us, including me, describing it in terms of the kind of the big chieftain, you know, divvying out sweeties to his followers. I'm looking here at this thing. This is Pat Breen, TD, Minister of State across the Departments of Enterprise and Innovation, the Department of Employment and Social Protection, the Department of the Taoiseach, and the Department of Justice and Equality, with special responsibility for trade, employment, business, EU, digital, single market, and data protection. What kind of a bloody job is that?
One that you need to know your brief very well. That's the thing about junior ministers. They span them across all these departments. So they create these new departments in the shape that they want the government to be. So we saw last week he reorganised the Department of Jobs. A lot of responsibility for labour market activation went to his old Department of Social Protection, and suddenly they have to fit all these junior ministries into these holes. But interestingly, like, the jobs are such that invariably they focus on one real responsibility of their jobs. So Pat Breen, despite his, you know, voluminous job description, will probably see himself as the junior minister in the Department of Enterprise and Employment.
Yeah.
And he'll probably have four offices across town because
he'll have four offices.
Yeah,
four offices with desks and phones and
Every department he's in will have an office for him because he's a minister in department as well as his ministerial office in Leinster House. So we'll have five departments. I jokingly said to someone, you know, you want to Airbnb a few of these out, you know, in the summer months to get yourself a few quid.
Are you serious?
My understanding is, I know a couple of ministers who are across a couple of departments and they say, look, I've got three, but like I really spend most of my time in this one. Like, you know,
have they never heard of hot desking?
No.
I think if a junior minister is wise, he or she picks three issues that they could make a name for themselves on. Because, you know, really, there's a lot of...
I mean, there's some big, what looks like big things here, you know? The EU digital single market, you know, data protection. Those are huge issues in their own right.
I suppose there's a sense that a junior minister is the stand-in when the senior can't be there.
Yeah.
They're a half car, that's the joke, you know, and they get a good view from the foothills. But, well, you know, we could be proved wrong here. Leo Varadkar might actually prove to be a good delegator in this regard. He has said he'll give the Taoiseach extra responsibilities. So
the tenor of yesterday's cabinet meeting was supposed to be far different than what has gone before.
How so?
A lot more collaborative, you know, seeking views across the table. It went on longer than usual cabinet meetings, although the business wasn't heavier than it was previously. Just, you know, sought a lot more views. What do you think of this? What do you think of that?
Because we were led to believe that one of the changes that would take place from the transition from Kenny to Varadkar would be that Kenny was a more presidential type leader and that Varadkar might be more of a micromanager or into all the detail. Is that the case?
I think a micromanager wouldn't be correct. I think someone who takes a keener interest in the policy briefs in front of him would be correct, but he's not going to get bogged down into why isn't this target being met here? I think what he does do in the speech last week, and the Dáil bore it out, he identifies broad ranges that he wants the departments. I mean, he has a vision for his government and he says to people, I want you to implement this, come back to me when it's done, or I will ask you for a progress report. Whereas Kenny was more likely to sit back and let it flow, that he would let cabinet subcommittees and cabinet meetings flow, and that he would let others challenge ministers and civil servants on the detail of what was before them. I think Varadkar would be a different beast of a different stripe, and that he knows the policies inside out himself and will be kind of keener to challenge people on issues. Whereas Kenny was presidential in style, but it goes back to the 2011 general election when Kenny recognised that you know, smartly, that he was not the big seller for Fine Gael. The public didn't buy him. So he had to sell his team as the main, you know, this is the Fine Gael team. And the nature of that is he delegates out a lot to. So Michael Noonan was given basically carte blanche to run the Department of Finance as he saw fit, as long as it didn't stray outside the lines of what Kenny wanted. I think this is going to be different. Varadkar has a very firm idea of what his government to be.
There is other stuff going on. There was quite remarkable hearings yesterday at the PAC. And have a listen to this exchange between Mary Lou McDonnell and the Garda Commissioner, Noreen O'Sullivan.
Absolutely not, Deputy. And maybe if I can just point out to something. This document is dated the 24th of October 2015. Yes. And as I said earlier, there are many ways of...
Excuse me. You're not doing that. Stick to the knitting here. Sorry.
With respect.
I don't want a big, long
narrative
from you.
With respect, we are not knitting here. I have been asked a question, and I would like to answer the question,
and I'd like you
please.
To answer briefly.
Yes. So if you can allow me to answer the question,
briefly.
Please. Yes.
And to the point.
To the point.
Yes.
When this letter is dated the 24th of October 2015.
Yes.
In effect, the working group, which was set up to establish this, was set up on the 6th of August 2015, yes. The first meeting of the group.
Yes.
The department, my understanding is, were involved in this. So my point was that there are many ways of ensuring that the department are kept fully informed. And that was one way of making sure that the department were fully informed. A Section 41 does not always need to take the form of a letter.
Right. So under no circumstances... I think with all due respect, Commissioner, now you're doing a bit of, verbal Pilates here in terms of how you're presenting facts. Anyway, I just wanted to establish, you did not interpret Mr. Culhane's letter as an attempt to dissuade one way or the other as regards your disclosure. Is that right?
No, Deputy, okay. I don't do Pilates and I don't do knitting.
Okay, well, I'm delighted. I'm not interested in your pastimes.
So that was a fairly frosty exchange between Mary Lou McDonald and Noreen O'Sullivan. Quite a gendered exchange, actually, I think, Mary. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, it was a bit odd, wasn't it? Obviously, we were kind of steeped in the other stories yesterday, but I was hearing all this talk about knitting and Pilates coming out. I didn't really know what it was about, so it was great to hear that exchange in full. I mean,
Conor Laddie in today's Irish Times says that the committee members, I quote, were unable to disguise their distrust and incredulity, which is kind of pretty accurate summing up of the relationship now, isn't it?
I think so. I think you could hear disdain in the voice of the questioners quite a lot. I talk about this getting into Gubu territory. Like, it's absolutely bizarre, the headlines that we've got now. And we've got so much coverage of it today. The lead story, Garda official attempted to muddy things up. That's in reference to a letter. Mm. And then just the few other...
Yeah, there is, Jen, like, you know, there's disdain from the guards towards the members of the committee because they feel they're grandstanding. There's disdain from the members of the committee towards the Garda management because they feel they're not being, you know, thorough in their answers. And I thought Mary Lou McDonald's questioning there was evident of that. Like, Noreen O'Sullivan is very polished, falls back in managerial speak quite a lot, can talk down the clock. We talked about turning over rocks and things come out. Da, 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 da. But I'm not sure. The PAC is a very good instrument when it works properly. It's very poor when it doesn't work. And I think, I'm not sure that this is...
And it degenerates into showboating, doesn't
it? Yeah, and I think that there are risks always attached to that. Like, you know, Alan Kelly has appointed himself as the Inquisitor-in-Chief on this particular PAC, and he's trying to get Anshin out of Norwich, quite rightly, but I just think that if you were to ask someone to go behind closed doors and investigate these matters, it would be done in a much more expeditious manner.
Yeah, does this sort of infect the broader political system? I mean, obviously, I have no doubt that the government, the new government, would like it just to be sort of sterilised and put off in a box, really, as the various inquiries take their course.
Yeah, it's a lingering sore, isn't it? Like, it's run right through the last administration and it's still going strong in this one. Like, there's no sign of it going away anytime soon. It's a tricky one for Leo Varadkar, isn't it? I mean, yeah. I think he knows that getting rid of the woman at the top is not going to solve the problem.
No.
But he has also made very strong comments about accountability and the need for accountability. So where he actually takes that is going to be fascinating.
Yeah, the politicians of all kind of parties say, like, it is a mess, but you often hear them saying, but it's not just Noreen O'Sullivan, it's a mess across the top, and what good would taking her out do? Now,
Is that a universal view, though? It's not. It's obviously not a universal
view. Well, it's just on my way in here, I bumped into an opposition TD and I was chatting to him about it. And he said, oh, look, we've obviously called for Niall Sullivan to go, but the whole thing is an absolute mess. It's just across the board. But he felt that it would be a significant public statement were she to step aside. But she shows no sign of doing so. The opposition, as in Fianna Fáil, who are the key players in all this, have said they're not going to table a motion of confidence, which has no legal effect. Anyway, the policing authority is not going to do anything about it, and Niall Sullivan isn't going to go of her own volition. And the criteria for removing her is quite strict. So it would need to be a far more significant issue than this, I think, to move on the question of whether she stays or goes.
So, Mary, I was looking at reports of this, these very elongated discussions, really, between the DUP and the Conservative Party for support of Theresa May's government. The Tories seem to be completely surprised and blindsided by the demands the DUP are making, the process of negotiation which the DUP are seeking. And the DUP, in turn, is very taken yesterday, but there are comments coming out of the DUP essentially saying the Tories don't know how to negotiate, which would make you a bit worried about the Brexit talks as well.
Yeah, it would. I think it was very naive of Theresa May to come out so early in the process and sort of declare a deal was done. I mean, this is the DUP we're talking about. Like, these people are deal brokers extraordinaire for decades now, and they've been steeped in the minutiae of Northern Ireland politics, and you know they're kind of schooling Theresa May a bit. It's humiliation heaped on humiliation for her, and yes, the DUP's line yesterday to show some respect. You know, they really are, talk about revenge being a dish served cold. Like, they were very sore about not being included in the debates ahead of the last general election in the UK, whereas, you know, parties in Wales and the Green Party and so on were. They were very, very angry about that, and now they are absolutely delighted that Newsnight is doing a special focus on them and so on.
So is part of that then, is part of that what's driving what's going on, that they actually, it's in their interest as far as they're concerned, and as you say, there's a bit of revenge there as well to just make sure that this thing drags out?
In fairness, I don't know that they are dragging it out. I mean, these are extremely complex issues that we're dealing with here that,
like,
you know,
what?
Go back hundreds of years.
Well, what are we talking about?
Well, first of all, you're talking money, right?
Yeah.
Extracting money from the British Exchequer is not easy.
The British Exchequer has been extracting billions of pounds sterling out of the British economy.
Well, what
for
I hear from
years.
Contacts in the north is the British Exchequer is very, very clever at, you know, dressing old money up as new and presenting it to you as if you've got something wonderful, but actually when you look at it, this money was promised before.
Okay.
So there's that. And then there's the, you know, the really, really detailed stuff about, like, the Irish Language Act and, you know, all these things that have been contentious in Northern Ireland for years and are not just going to get sorted out in a couple of days in 10 Downing Street. You know, I think Arlene Foster has also to make, you know, make a political calculation. How long is this administration going to last? You know, is Theresa May, you remember the phrase political corpse that Shane Ross used about Enda Kenny and caused...
Dead woman walking.
Yeah, caused such consternation. But, you know, that's probably the case.
The only thing that's saving her is that there's nobody else as of now to replace her.
So part of the deal from the DUP's point of view, Fiacc, is that if they're going to get some cash, they want it fast.
Yeah.
For that reason.
And, like, I think Mary is right. Like, it was too simplistic to assume all this would be wrapped up within a matter of days. Like, we saw how long...
Is that Tory grandee's arrogance?
I think it's just they don't know. They're not used to dealing with these type of talks. Like, the last coalition they had in the UK, 2010, Tories and Lib Dems, was done, I think, was it 4 days?
Yeah.
It was over, but that was a full-on coalition. You get your manifesto and your manifesto, you go, that bit, that bit, that bit, that bit. You'll have these jobs, that jobs. This is more complex. It's a confidence supply. As we saw with our own confidence supply negotiations last year, it's really detailed. And European, like, after elections in Europe, like, these negotiations go on forever.
But seriously, though, am I not then right to be completely terrified by David Davis shows up for the start of the talks this week, and apparently they didn't have full position papers. Barnier is there with these vast quantities of position papers on every issue, and he's just there.
There's been a cartoon, I think, in the Telegraph yesterday of a big long table. At one end was Barnier with a quite tidy notebook open, and the other end was David Davis fumbling with all these papers that say single market, customs union, DUP, minority government. They don't know, but it depends on your point of view.
So we've got an incompetent government unable to negotiate the most important negotiation possibly of this century. And we're all depending on them getting something good out of this.
Well, this is it. We're in the extraordinary situation where the DUP, I mean, everybody has a laugh now about its failed campaign to save Ulster from sodomy. But, you know, the DUP could actually be the party that saves Ireland from a hard Brexit. I can't believe we're here.
Neither can I. We'll leave it there. Thanks very much, Marian Feig. And that's it for this edition of Inside Politics. Thanks to our producer, Declan Conlon, and our engineer, JJ Vernon. Remember that you can mail me at hlinehan@irishtimes.com, or you can find me on Twitter. But until the next time, goodbye, and thanks very much indeed for listening.